Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Annie Griffiths is one of National Geographic's first female staff photographers, a feat she pulled off while also raising two children. That may explain why she may be the only professional photographer ever to pack her camera gear in Pampers. She's visited every continent save for Antarctica and managed to find a way to stay close to her kids without putting the brakes on her career. And what a career! Her photographs, some of which can be viewed on our website at kcur.org, will stop you. Dozens of white pelicans on the Mississippi Delta, camels in Jordan seen through gaps in giant rock walls, and an absolutely stunning photo of a man standing atop the very edge of Victoria Falls in Zambia, sunlight streaming behind him. Annie Griffiths will speak in town on February 28th, more on that in a moment, and she joins us this morning from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. And Annie, good morning. So nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
So why does absolutely everybody want to be a National Geographic photographer, Annie? Because, you know, whether they're a photographer or not, everyone just seems to think that's just the greatest job in the world.
Well, they're right. It's a great job. You know, and probably not always in the way people assume it is. I mean, I think there is a perception that somebody just pays for you to travel and take pictures, which,
right,
of course, is not the case. What happens is actually much more interesting than that, because National Geographic has been known for giving the photographers a tremendous amount of time to really get close to people and cultures, to show things that haven't been seen before or show them in a new way. And, you know, it just doesn't get any better than that.
So you actually sort of move in, right? And you have said when you traveled with your children, you didn't stay in hotels. You actually lived with the people you were shooting, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I actually, before my first child was born, I had this nightmare one night that I walked into a hotel room and there was this demon child watching MTV and ordering room service. And I took it as a sign that probably hotels are not great for kids. So we would stay, you know, in apartments, beach houses, once we lived on a kibbutz. But I would basically locate the kids in a place where their lives could go on fairly normally and there would be around other families and children. And then I would just come and go from shooting, because, of course, they couldn't come on the shoots either. They, you know, if you're their mom, you belong to them. So,
yeah. What was the toughest part about bringing your kids along with you on those trips?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. It was mostly so terrific. You know, I just think navigating everything for their schools, because they went to a regular public school, and I worked very closely with their teachers, who were incredibly supportive. I never had a teacher question what we were doing. And I just made sure the kids brought back to the classroom special presentations from wherever we'd gone.
Mm-hmm. Your kids are older now, right? 18 and
they
20,
are.
Something like that?
They are, yes.
Have they decided, what influence did your work have on them as they consider their own pursuits now in their lives?
Well, you know, they're incredibly interesting citizens of the planet because they've traveled so much. And my daughter is very interested and currently working with nonprofits, especially working with women and girls in emerging nations, and my son is an art student. And, you know, he is doing film this semester, so we'll see if he comes back to the camera. But each of them has found a path that I think certainly stems from how they grew up, but also it's their own footprint.
Well, it's interesting that your daughter is involved in a nonprofit, but because besides doing what you do for National Geographic, you are also executive director of something called Ripple Effect. What is that?
It's Ripple Effect Images, and what it is it's a collective of National Geographic photographers, mostly women, who have been doing work for aid organizations for years, and I had been for 20 years. So at a certain point, I called them all, they're my girlfriends, and said, what if we work together? I think we can get a lot more done. So we formed Ripple Effect Images, and we document the programs that are empowering women and girls in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then we donate that work to the nonprofits.
What impact is it having?
You know, it's having a great impact. For example, we're particularly interested in how much climate change affects women and girls so much more than men.
Why is that?
So, well, if you know, it's something you don't think about till you think about it. But
right.
You know, if there's drought, it's women and girls who go further and further for water and haul the water back. And you know, in one program we covered in Kenya, women and girls were walking 11 hours a day just to bring water. So, of course, they
11 hours a day. Wow.
11 hours a day. Yep. And this program taught them how to build a sand dam and trap the water so that they only had a 30-minute walk. And then, of course, the girls could go to school.
Well,
things like that.
I'm guessing that given the arc of your career, ripple effect seems like something like a very natural offshoot of what you've done. Am I seeing that correctly?
Absolutely, because, you know, I've traveled to about 125 countries, and so often I've observed what women deal with. And I think too often in our country they're presented as just victims, and the truth is they are resilient, resourceful, smart. They work well together. They pay it forward to their communities. So to me, over time, I began to see that women are really, women and girls are the best investment in the future.
You know, you have said any number of things about photography. In fact, Annie, you're pretty quotable, as a matter of fact. But one thing you have said is the craziest and most curious photographers on earth are those who seek wonder. What does seeking wonder mean to you?
Well, I think we all experience it occasionally. We experience it a lot when we're kids. And like right now, I have a granddaughter. My daughter has a little girl who's 10 months old.
Well, congratulations.
And, thank you. It's just so much fun. But, she experiences wonder about every 10 minutes. But we do too. I mean, it's sort of like when you look at a photograph and you gasp and go, oh, look at that. And I think that we are all moving so fast that it's hard for us to remember to slow down and just stand in awe. Like the other night, I was literally coming out of the grocery store and the moon was full and it was coming up like a big pizza pie. You know, it was just an amazing moon. And I just made myself stop and look at it for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then send a text to my son and say, have you seen the moon?
You know, your photographs, I got to tell you, if our listeners are near a computer and can go to kcur.org, we have a slideshow that was put up by our producer, Steven Steigman, last night. And these photographs will stop you because they are just absolutely stunning. Let me ask you about some of them, and we can talk about these are images that are on our website here, Annie. One of them is a photo of dozens of white pelicans on the Mississippi Delta that was taken from way above. And the other colors in the photograph are browns and blacks, but the white pelicans stand out so clearly. Tell us about that shot, how you got it, and what you were hoping for when you took that picture.
I was hoping that it would be sharp.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is I was up in a light plane. I really like doing aerials from a light plane. And I was actually taking a look at the damage to the salt marsh caused by the oil industry because it's been sliced up so much. And, of course, the more you slice up a salt marsh, the more vulnerable it becomes. And as we were photographing different aspects of that early in the morning, I looked and I saw this group of pelicans. And I had a great pilot because I said to him, look, we're going to get one pass before, you know, they'll fly. And I didn't want to go too low because I didn't want to, you know, disturb them too much. And I told him what I wanted to fly over and he took me over and I got the shot. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's a single frame that works if you're lucky. So, but yeah, it just sort of has an elegance to it, just the curve.
Oh, yeah. It is the curve. That's right. That's now that you say that really resonates with me. I mean, did you shoot actually through the window of the plane or you couldn't have done that, right? You shot. So how did you do that?
That particular day, I believe we had the door off the airplane. You know, you either shoot through an open window or you take the door off, and taking the door off is gives you more opportunity. And I think that day we had the door off.
And are you actually, so you don't get blown out of the plane, how are you doing that?
Well, they put you in a pretty good seatbelt.
Okay. And so you can lean over and get what you need to get.
Oh, yeah. And it's not, I've never felt the least bit concerned about it. I have a real comfort with heights.
Hey, how about another photograph on our website, camels in Jordan seen through gaps in these giant rock walls. And one thing that really struck me about this particular photograph that people can see is the curve of the rock on the sort of the right side of the photo matches sort of the contours of a camel's head. Am I seeing that correctly? Can you recall what I'm talking about?
I can, but at the time, you know, so often when you're shooting, you're seeing things you don't even know you're seeing.
Right,
you know,
right.
There's a sort of visual acuity that you develop over time. And in that particular instance, I was mainly just trying to get the frame. I saw the camels coming, and I wanted to get the frame at the exact moment they were in the right place. So I was focusing on that. But your instinct to compose is, it just becomes like breathing.
So did you, were you intentionally trying to get sort of the contours of the wall very close to the camel's head so you, there was a connection there? Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I mean, I was unaware. What I was trying to show, the picture was taken in Petra, which is this absolutely extraordinary city carved from sandstone. And it existed because the Nabataean people who lived there learned how to trap and hold water in the desert. So Petra became this great stopping point on the trade routes, and it's still there. You still see a city. I mean, it's been through some earthquakes, so there's been some destruction, but you still see a city carved from the sandstone. And I really wanted to give that feeling, and that is just a guy who lives there walking through the. City.
How long were you sitting, Annie, inside wherever you were? I gather some kind of rock chamber, just waiting for those camels to walk by.
You know, on that one, I wasn't waiting all that long. I was outside the cave, and I saw them coming, and so then I hopped inside the cave. Because a lot of times, you know, you need an element. You've got a frame in mind. You've got an idea in mind, but you need an element that gives it life. And so my hope was that he would, you know, the camels would be walking right by those openings. And that's where people used to live. I was inside a cave.
So composing photographs like the pelicans, like this one, you're saying that's just become a second instinct to you now as you go about your work every day?
Yeah, to a great extent. I mean, I'm always, it's sort of like a musician is always learning a little bit more about instruments and sound and how things work together. And the same is true with visuals, that you become more and more attuned and more sophisticated in your seeing. And, you know, also in your anticipation of what is about to happen, may happen. There's sort of a gut involvement as well.
So how often do you wind up being surprised when you look at your photographs after a day of shooting? Are you surprised you've come up with things that you didn't know you would come up with?
You know, it's funny because that doesn't happen very often. It's more that, especially before there was digital, where you didn't see anything sometimes for a month or two.
Yes.
There's this celebration immediately after you think something fantastic has happened, followed probably about 20 minutes later by a certainty that you screwed it up somehow, that that it could, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, you're sure you've got nothing.
Yeah.
There was a lot of insecurity, and there remains a lot of insecurity in the job. But now with digital, you know, you can confirm that you either got it or you didn't get it. And that's certainly comforting when you're traveling for a long period of time.
And with digital, are you sending back your images on a daily basis to National Geo offices back here in this country, or
not so much?
No. Okay.
No, I think, you know, people who work for newspapers and news magazines and things like that are doing that more. The primary job, when I'm shooting for Geographic, or really most clients, to protect the material, to download it, to back it up, to make sure that it can't disappear. Which sometimes amuses me because we used to shoot all transparencies, which are incredibly fragile, and there was only one. And, you know, but now that you have the capability to back up, photographers have become kind of paranoid about it.
Mm-hmm. Andy Griffiths is our guest. She's one of the first female staff photographers for National Geographic, and you'll have a chance to see her on February 28th at the Kauffman Center's Helzberg Hall. She'll be presenting a program titled A Camera, Two Kids and a Camel, based on a book she did a few years ago. Again, that'll be at the Kauffman Center. More information on our website, kcur.org. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation with Andy Griffiths, 816-235-2888. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR Uptodate. Let's go to Austin from Kansas City, Missouri. Austin, good morning.
Good morning. I guess she answered one of my questions about which kind of, did she shoot digital or film yet, you know, that kind of thing. But what kind of cameras does she use?
What kind of cameras, Annie?
Well, I shoot all 35 millimeter, and the first camera I ever had was a Canon FTB, and then when I went to newspapers, they only had Nikon lenses, so I had to sell that camera. Oh, boy, would I love to have it back. Mm. And I've been Nikon ever since, but, you know, there are so many good cameras out there right now that, you know, you just more have to think about what works for you? What kind of features do you want?
They're better cameras today than they were 20 years ago?
Sure, a lot better. Yeah. I mean, you know, it used to be that when autofocus first came out, it was kind of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started, I was using cameras that didn't have light meters in them.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I worked with a light meter for many, many years.
Digital versus working with film, what are your thoughts?
Well, a camera is a camera is a camera, so that part of it is not difficult. Once the quality got terrific, and it really is terrific, you know, the whole industry changed. So many of us who loved film and really knew the emulsion, and we went screaming and kicking into digital. But, you know, it's got some advantages over film, and film has some advantages over it. But basically, you know, the hardest thing for me is that you have to become the lab now, too. You've got to do all the downloading and backing up and working the images and all that.
And that takes a lot of time, I gather.
Tons of time.
Yeah. Yep. Do you do your own editing now, or are photo editors still very much a part of your life?
Oh, no. Photo editors are very, very important. Mm-hmm. And National Geographic has fantastic photo editors.
Mm-hmm.
I myself am a pretty good editor. And so I edit books for Geographic every once in a while. I do other projects because I really enjoy working with other people's pictures as well.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about one other image that's on our website, and this photograph again really stopped me. There's this really stunning photo of a man standing atop what looks like the very edge of Victoria Falls in Zambia, sunlight streaming behind him. And I gather, Annie, he didn't go over the falls, did he? I worried
no.
about it. I worried about it just for a second when I looked at the photograph.
No, he is inches from the edge.
He is inches from the edge.
He is inches from the edge, yep. You know, it sort of says a lot about going in with expectations. Victoria Falls is one of the most extraordinary waterfalls on Earth. Hmm. And when it's roaring, when that river is roaring, you know, you can't even see the falls because the spray is so huge. So I had been there before, but when I went this time, the falls was running very, very slowly. And at first I was disappointed. But in talking to some of the local people, one of the guys said, yeah, it's really, you know, this happens every once in a while, and that's the only time you can swim. So
swim, yeah.
Which piqued my curiosity, so I said, what do you mean swim? And he said, you know, there's a swimming hole at the top of the falls. And I said, yeah, right.
Really?
And so anyway, it is true that the locals know about this, and I guess a lot more people know about it now, but it's the only time when the water is running very, very slowly that you can actually get out the river and to the top of the falls without being eaten, because the crocodiles and the hippos are smarter than humans, so they won't go that near the edge. So you have to swim out there and walk out there, and then there literally is a beautiful little swimming hole, and we were out there for probably 2 hours, and I photographed them jumping and playing and having fun. But it was really as we turned to leave that I looked back, and this extraordinary moment happened where, you know, a man who grew up there was standing atop one of the great features on the planet and having kind of a private moment as the sun was setting. And it just, that's one where you go, oh man, I really don't want to screw this up.
So you knew right away it was a winner. Just looking
Oh, yeah. I had goosebumps when I turned around and I saw it, just his body language and everything was so intimate, you know, so private.
Were you standing in the water or were you shooting from shore?
Oh, no, there is no shore.
You were in the water, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we had to be in the water for quite a while to get out there.
And you weren't worried about hippos or crocodiles?
No, because we were so close to the edge, and I knew that those animals would never, ever go that close.
Hmm. You know, I read that you had no real interest in photography, Annie, until you took a course at the University of Minnesota as a junior in college. So you didn't get hooked on all of this until you were pretty far along in college then.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was always going to be a writer from the time I was a little kid. But it wasn't that I wasn't interested in photography, because my parents always had, they had National Geographic and they had Life magazine and Look magazine.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I remember laying on my belly. I remember specific issues of those magazines because I would just pore over
them. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm sure that imprint stayed with me. I think it just never occurred to me that I could do it as a job until I took a class, and 2 weeks later, it was like falling in love. I changed my major.
I was going to say, did the light bulb go off pretty quickly for you then?
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you wound up getting a job as a kid at a newspaper, right, in Minnesota. And you had ended up providing National Geographic with a hailstorm photograph they had called for one day. And then I read a year later, you just called National Geographic up and you pitched them an idea for a story. What did you pitch them?
Well, I didn't really call them up. I sent them a portfolio and a proposal. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it was really quite a simple thing. I had been invited to do a canoe trip up in Canada, a really interesting canoe trip. So I wrote that up as a story and I sent in a portfolio, never dreaming that they would say yes. But the director of photography, Bob Gilka, who's just a lion of photojournalism, was really very focused on diversifying his group of shooters. You know, here's National Geographic covering the world, and all they had was a bunch of white guys. So he was very actively trying to look for women and minorities, and I was certainly a beneficiary of that search.
You came from a newspaper in Minnesota that had a pretty good reputation as a shooter's newspaper, right?
I sure did.
What paper was that again?
The Worthington Daily Globe.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yep. That's where, and the only other photographer when I was hired, they'd only had one photographer, Jim Brandenburg, who's a very famous photographer now. And the year I graduated, they had decided to add a second person and they chose me. So it was also like an internship for a couple of years, watching, you know, working beside someone who was just so far along in his career.
So when you made your pitch to National Geographic, did they write you back or call you back and say, sure, Annie, go do it? And how
That's
did you
a funny thing. It was funny because I was literally up on a road along the north shore of Lake Superior on this really rainy day, and I pulled over and called home, called and talked to my mother, and she said that this guy had called from National Geographic. And so I got the number and I called him from a pay booth on the North Shore. And if he could have seen me, he would not have hired me. I had been camping, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, when can you start? Can you start next week?
No kidding.
And No kidding. And that, I found out a few years later, was the picture editor was the one who called me, but the directive came from Mr. Gilka, who said, her idea, you hire her. And, you know, off I went, and I never looked back.
You know, what made you think, as a kid, that you could just call the vaunted National Geographic out of the blue like that, or contact them and pitch a story and then maybe even hook on with them?
You know, I think it was that call that I received in the dark room when Mr. Gilka called, and I happened to pick up the phone, and, you know, he said, "You a photographer?" And I said, "Yes." I mean, he was very gruff and, you know, but just tenderhearted,
yeah.
But, you know, so I'm this kid in the dark room, and he said, "You a photographer?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Did you guys have a hailstorm last night?" I said, "Yes, sir." And I thought it was like a local farmer or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "This is Bob Gilka, National Geographic. Can you get a picture of hail damage? We need a picture of hail damage." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I sent it in, and they used it. So that gave me the courage, I think, to send in a proposal, thinking that maybe in 5 or 6 years I'd come up with something they might be interested in.
Well, speaking, I mentioned before you give good quotes. Here's another one from you from a few years ago. You said once that you spent the first decades thinking that if I really stay quiet and do my job, maybe they won't figure out they should never have hired me.
Absolutely.
How nervous were you those first months and even years at the National Geographic?
Well, you know, the funny thing is the first assignment, I wasn't all that nervous because I'd never been east of Ohio. I was too dumb to know that I was completely over my head. And fortunately, I didn't fall on my sword with the first assignment, but I really struggled with the second one because after the first one, they flew me out and I walked into these marbled halls and met with Mr. Gilka and a bunch of other people. And he was happy and he gave me another assignment. And I almost blew the second assignment because I recognized I was really over my head.
You knew it.
I knew it. Yeah. But they didn't. And it was like this, this cat and mouse thing, you know, that I, they had more faith in me than I had in myself.
Oh, that's neat.
And it was actually the second assignment. It was a wonderful picture editor, John Agnon, who recognized that I was panicking and couldn't have been nicer.
Helped you out. Okay, let's take a break, Annie. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. Again, you can see her on February 28th at the Kauffman Center. More information on our website, kcur.org, or go to the Kauffman Center's website for ticket information as well. We'll continue our conversation with Annie. We'll talk about what it was like being one of the few women to work at the National Geographic when she first began. And later on this hour, Brian McTavish joins us with our weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. You can hear yesterday's conversations with former sniper Chris Kyle and martial artist Linda Hansen at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we examine Johann Sebastian Bach's contributions to keyboard and orchestra literature, ask what this mild winter weather means for your garden, and hear our latest installment of A Fan's Notes. But this hour, we're talking with Annie Griffiths. She's with National Geographic, one of the first female staff photographers there. And Annie, we're getting all kinds of good questions from listeners here at UpToDate at KCUR.org. Sergio wants to know, she's wondering, how did you develop that amazing photography eye? And when you shoot portraits, how do you get your subject to act naturally and be their true self? Yes.
Well, you know, I think that often when we think about photographing strangers, our own shyness is really the biggest obstacle.
Mm.
And we're quite willing to put it on them. You know, oh, I don't want to disturb them. Oh, they might not like it. Oh, but the truth is, it's kind of like going into a swimming pool. You know, you can dip your toe and then your ankle and make it excruciatingly painful, or you just go for it. And
mm-hmm.
I think the key to photographing people is to be sincere. If it's someone that is doing something that's cute, you don't want to interrupt what they're doing. You know, you want to shoot. But then when they look up, the worst thing you can do is hide or turn away.
Mm.
It's much better to smile and do a thumbs up, or, you know, or just mouth the word cute, or, you know, and then later go up to them and talk to them, you know, spend time with them. I really believe that that's the element we often forget that people are going to feel better if you go over and say, gosh, you know, I just love that polka dot dress you're wearing. And, you know, it's something that tells them a positive reason why you were taking that picture and how great they are. You know, I sometimes in an audience, I'll say, how many of you have ever been in the newspaper or on television? And I'll say, and how many of you hated it? You know, or did you cut it out and send it to your mom? And, you know, it's just true that so many of us rarely have anyone pay attention to us. And it's exciting. It's flattering.
We have this comment from Joanna on our website. She writes this: I'm from Monrovia, Liberia. Your statement about letting people know that you know or share in their beauty or their lives without having to speak the same language was heartwarming to me. I was on the plane from Brussels to Chicago and met a family who spoke only French. Their little son was having a difficult moment, and I felt their concern. So I spoke with the mother using my hands, and she understood me. I just love that communication can happen even without that shared language. And she says, your photographs are simply incredible.
Oh, how nice. No, she's absolutely right. I mean, I intentionally try not to work with an interpreter most of the time because it can put a wall between you and the subject. And it's much better to pantomime and make an idiot out of yourself and know just a handful of little words and have direct communication that just brings walls down immediately.
So when you do an assignment for National Geographic, you know, Annie, you're talking about having time to talk with people. How much time does the Geographic give you for a standard assignment, if there is such a thing?
Well, that's changed dramatically since I began. But my assignments used to be 2 or 3 months most often. And now, you know, it's down to 4 to 6 weeks.
Really?
Yeah, because publishing's under so much pressure, and National Geographic is no exception.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still blown away by the quality of the work that my colleagues produce in that compressed time range. You know, so but what you do have time and do have an excuse for with a camera is to meet someone, and if you're really interested in their lives, say, can I spend the day with you? Can I meet your family? Can I, you know, that's the great gift. It's not sort of like an hour long assignment where you've got to get a shot of Jerusalem. It's much more you yourself can navigate the best way to cover this topic. And that's artistic freedom that, you know, I've always embraced.
Denise sends us this email. Annie, do you use Lightroom software, and what is your favorite lens?
I do use Lightroom software. Yes, I do, and I love it. You know, my favorite lens is a wide lens. I like to work very close to people, and I find that wide lenses are really nice also for landscapes and so many things. Basically, a wide-angle lens, like, you know, a 24-35, will allow you to be more intimate with your subject. You know, I think that there's that perception that you can put on a really long telephoto lens, and then and then the person won't know you're taking their picture, and you'll get a close-up. And it doesn't really work that way.
Why not?
Well, because you're not close to them. And when you... And long lenses are wonderful lenses. They can be used for many things. But if you really want the viewer to feel close to the person, then you need to be close to the person.
Well, that's interesting. Because the wide-angle lens, of course, makes the subject appear farther away, so you need to get physically closer to get what you need, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And it allows something magical to happen between you and that person, too, because you have just taken away the boundary of I'm a stranger, you're a stranger. You've just gotten close to them.
Well, that's interesting to me because I would have thought just the opposite, as you explained, that a long lens would get me closer and I'd be unobtrusive, and that's how you get these really natural shots. And you're saying maybe not.
No, because, well, in my personal experience, yes, you can get that every once in a while. But if you want great pictures, you got to earn them. And one of the most important ways to earn them is to be with people, to earn their trust, to earn their respect, to, you know, let natural things evolve.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, update@kcur.org. Our guest again, Annie Griffiths of National Geographic. We were talking before the break about being one of the first women hired at the National Geographic. How well were you accepted early on there?
Oh, man, everybody was so nice to me.
Okay.
I can't tell you. You know, I think there's a perception that women are getting chased around desks or something back in those days. And the single biggest thing that I had to overcome was well-intentioned bosses who felt very protective of women. You know, that happened at the newspaper. I remember the publisher at the newspaper that I went to didn't want me to shoot high school sports on the weekend because he didn't want me driving the Iowa roads
right.
at night. And, you know, that, and so it was well intentioned, but I really had to sit down with him and also with other bosses and say, I can't be the girl photographer here. I have to be one of the photographers.
It wasn't
you for your concern.
Your first assignment at the newspaper in Minnesota, wasn't that to go up high in, it was a grain elevator or something, and you had to go up in an elevator an elevator of some kind. They didn't want you to go up there?
It wasn't my first assignment at all, but it was the one where I had to sit down and have the conversation because the publisher was feeling so protective of me, and he didn't think it was safe. And he, you know, I didn't resent it. I just knew I had to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
It was well intended. It wasn't a mean discriminatory thing. But
at National Geographic, maybe there was some hesitancy to send you to exotic locales like in Africa or Afghanistan or something.
Well, I think it took a while for management at Geographic to be comfortable sending any of the women certain places. It's like watching your kid get on the school bus for the first time. I think when you got someone who seems more vulnerable to you and who's you know, starting in a career that has not been a woman's career very much, there's just this anxiety that's human nature.
How many shooters does National Geographic have these days?
Well, there are no staff photographers. The photography is all done under contract and has been for some time, and that's the way the whole industry works, really. The staff days are pretty much over at magazines. And so at any one time, you know, they probably have 30 people shooting on one project or another.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there are people who do one story or, you know, every 5 years do something. So it's a fluid situation.
You know, once on an assignment, elephants charged you.
A couple times.
what happened and where were you? And what's that like?
Well, you know, I got to say that I was with another photographer and he dropped his camera and I didn't. So I had
to... You hung in there.
I hung in there. I take some pride in that. And then that was in Namibia. And then...
What did you do?
There is nothing you can do. It's up to her. It's usually a female, you know, and you see the ears go.
Yeah.
And you realize she's coming at you like a freight train, and it's all up to her. There's not a thing you can do. I know the guide laid on the horn the first time, both times, and then the second time an elephant charged me, I was actually with my mother.
Lovely. Yeah.
I had taken her on safari, and she made me look like a wreck because she was so calm throughout it. But it's a really humbling experience.
Well, wait a minute. When the guide laid on the horn, why didn't he step on the gas? I mean, you just sat there?
There's no time. You know,
they're too fast.
They are so fast. Yeah. In fact, when I was with my mom, another guide put it in reverse really fast and ended up backed up over a log, and we had to go rescue his people.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's just, there are certain situations where it's all up to the animal.
And so the elephant eventually stopped, I gather.
Yep.
Fortunately.
Yep. And they usually do. You know, they usually do. But it's like, okay, you know, I'm sending a message here. Get out of my face. You know, you're too close, or you're between me and my baby, or, you know, there's something going on.
You've also gotten too close to lions. What happened there?
Well, I've gotten very close to lions. The one time that somebody did something really stupid, and this was early on when, you know, you could do little recordings on your phone. And this earlier, he had recorded a lion roaring. And then we were, and this was a guy who just happened to be in the vehicle who I didn't know. And we were close to another male lion, and he decided to play the roar. And that lion came up, and I mean, really not the brightest move. So, but again, it's, you know, you're right there, you're in an open vehicle, it's up to the cat.
Wow. Well, Annie, I sure enjoyed having you here. Thanks so much for taking
some
time. And again, folks can see and hear Annie on February 28th at the Kauffman Center's Helzberg Hall. More information on our website, kcur.org. Annie, you just did a great job. You were just a wonderful guest. Thanks so much for
taking
some time.
It was delightful.
All the best. You bet.
Thanks.